save us from the lust and the damage. Yeah, tell me who's gonna save our world.
Who by Climate Action Network International, written for the climate justice activists as they danced to the song at the UN Climate Summit, COP29. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Politicians from all around the world, human rights organizations, environmental NGOs, they're greenwashing genocide at COP29 in Baku. Those are the words of our next guest, Arshak Makhijan, who led global calls to boycott this year's UN climate talks hosted in Baku as Azerbaijan continues to detain Armenian political prisoners. And as a new report released on the first day of COP29 by an international fact-finding mission found Azerbaijan committed ethnic cleansing against the Armenian people while it carried out massacres in Nagorno-Karabakh in 2023. The war led to the forced expulsion of some 100,000 Armenians from the region last year. The report, Why Are There No Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh, draws on more than 300 interviews with Karabakh Armenians who survived the attacks and describe human rights violations, including the torture and mass killing of Armenians by Azerbaijani forces with impunity. The report also found ongoing violations in Nagorno-Karabakh as Azerbaijan destroys Armenian cultural monuments, churches, cemeteries, and residential neighborhoods. Prominent Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg was among those who did not attend COP29 in protest. Instead, she spent time in Yerevan, Armenia.
Azerbaijan, as previous people here on stage have said, is an extremely repressive state, a petrol state that is planning to expand fossil fuel production and is responsible for ethnic cleansing. It is absolutely nauseating, to say the least, the hypocrisy, the extreme hypocrisy that this climate conference, COP29, is being held in that country right now. The continuous extreme hardships that many Armenians are facing because of the Azerbaijani military aggression, the torture, forcefully displacement, prisoners of war, hostages, and the ethnic cleansing and the extreme physical and psychological violence that people have experienced can in absolutely no way be justified.
So that was Greta Thunberg, not at the COP29, but in Yerevan, Armenia. Armenia did not participate in the COP29 climate summit in Baku due to Azerbaijan's refusal to free at least 23 Armenian political prisoners detained there. Meanwhile, other Armenian activists who planned to attend the talks, including our next guest, were denied visas to Azerbaijan. We go now to Berlin, Germany, where we're joined by Arshak Makhijan, exiled Russian, Armenian, anti-war, human rights and climate activist. His recent citizenship was revoked last year. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Arshak. So explain what happened. Interestingly, our studio at UN Climate Summit was right next to the Karabakh room. Talk about Armenia in relation to Azerbaijan and why you weren't there.
It's important to say that my grandparents, they have been deported from Nakhichevan Republic, and the same as all other Armenians, they have been deported from them. And the ethnic cleansing or genocide started not yesterday or not in 2023. Azerbaijani colonial policies, they started long ago. And what happened in Artsakh or Nagorno-Karabakh was continuation of the Armenian genocide. And like, I do not want to talk about me, that they denied me of visa, though my grandparents are from Nakhichevan. I want to talk about what happened to Armenians, what they survived, the blockade and then total ethnic cleansing. It was horrible. And the worst thing was that we were alone. Like, we were protesting in Berlin and all around the world, and all the people, all civil societies all around the world, they ignored the blockade and then the total ethnic cleansing. And the same happened at COP29, where Azerbaijan was greenwashing the genocide against Armenians. No one spoke up about it, not Greenpeace or not Human Rights Watch or not Amnesty International. I was also reading the reports on social media. I was reading the report of Human Rights Watch. 74 pages about human rights violations in Azerbaijan. Not a single word about Armenians. Then Amnesty report, 8 pages. Not a single word about Armenians. Greenpeace, they speak up against greenwashing or for indigenous rights. And then they totally ignore this issue while they participate at COP29. I was disappointed because I worked with Greenpeace a lot in Russia, also with Greenpeace International. I was disappointed in many things. I don't understand why Azerbaijan was allowed to greenwash the genocide. They declared that Nagorno-Karabakh and Nakhichevan now are the green zone. They're going to build a few solar plants, and they continuously destroyed the houses of my friends. They are looting their houses. They were looting their houses during the COP29. And everyone, they just ignored it during the conference. I'm totally disappointed in, like, all these organizations. And I believe they are complicit in the genocide and greenwashing genocide.
Can you talk about what the International Court of Justice and if the International Criminal Court have weighed in at this point? The ICJ ruling Armenia and Azerbaijan discrimination cases can proceed forward as they kind of sue each other?
Basically, ICJ had a decision that Azerbaijan had to guarantee the safe return of Armenians, but in contrary, they continue to destroy Armenians' homes. They are looting their houses. And the problem is also that Azerbaijan is blackmailing Armenian government, and they demand Eastern Armenia to stop these cases because they do not want them, and they blackmail Armenia by starting another war. So the thing is that Eastern Armenia is now in danger also, and the problem is that I'm really afraid that the Armenian government will stop these cases at some point to have a peace with Azerbaijan, and I believe that peace is impossible with Azerbaijan. International civil society should pressure Azerbaijani government. We should have embargo the same way as we have embargo on Russian fossil fuels. We should have an embargo on Azerbaijani fossil fuels. We should sanction all Azerbaijani politicians, and it's quite possible to put pressure on them because Azerbaijani ruling family, they have a lot of property in the UK. They have a lot of castles, and I also believe that the UK government is complicit because they BP, British Petroleum Corporation, is having a lot of projects also in Nagorno-Karabakh, where they ethnically cleansed Armenians. So I think it's really important to do something now to stop the Armenian genocide. What was happening was continuation of Armenian genocide, and we continue to be threatened. Every person who speaks up about it, they are being threatened by the Azerbaijan and also Turkey, because the Azerbaijan, they work with Turkey, and the ethnic cleansing or the genocide happened with complicity of Russia. Russian peacekeepers, they did nothing to stop it. And I think it's really important now for everyone to support Armenia and also to create platforms for Armenians from Artsakh, because Armenian government, they say that we don't represent Armenians from Artsakh. Because they are blackmailed by Azerbaijan. Also, they say that they don't represent Armenians from Western Armenia, and majority of Armenians in the diaspora, they are from the Western Armenia, which is now Eastern Turkey or occupied. So I think it's important right now to think why the international law doesn't apply to our region. Because what happened with Armenians at the beginning of 20th century, till today, we cannot return to Western Armenia. I cannot visit Nakhichevan. What about, if Nakhichevan is Azerbaijan, what about our indigenous rights? Also the same with Artsakh. So I think it's really important for us to demand from UN real action. They did nothing during the blockade. We were demanding them to send some food, some medication to do Artsakh. They did nothing. And now, they continue to do nothing. Though Armenians, they cannot return to their homes. And this is unacceptable. I have no trust in international law. I have no trust in institutions that they have built, and also civil society. And I think we should do something about it, because international law should apply to everyone.
You have Your last few years have been incredibly difficult, Arshak. We spoke to, I think, in Russia, and then when you went into exile, this is after Russia invaded Ukraine. We're now speaking to you in Berlin. If you can talk about, do you have Armenian citizenship?
Yeah, I was stateless for 1 year, and I applied for Armenian citizenship, and I got it, but so if Azerbaijan starts a war against Armenia, I will go out to fight against them because, yeah,
finally,
that's my country.
You make comparisons between what's happening with Armenia in relation to Azerbaijan to what's happening in Gaza. Your final thoughts.
I think, like, what is happening right now in Gaza, the genocide was in some ways inspired by what happened in Nagorno-Karabakh or Artsakh. The world ignored 1 year of blockade of Nagorno-Karabakh, and then, Aliyev had a successful ethnic cleansing. And now, he was hosting the COP29, a lot of world leaders, they were shaking his hands and pretending that he's not a war criminal. And so, I think these kind of atrocities, they inspire each other. Like, the same way Armenian genocide inspired Hitler to commit the Holocaust, and there was this quote of Hitler who remembers Armenians. So I think this is not just about Armenians, and what was happening, the greenwashing of genocide at COP29, it's not about Armenians. It is about everyone. The world failed us for the second time. And if we want to have a solution for everyone, and if we want to have trust in international law, NGOs, or whatever, we should work together and to fight against these dictators together. And instead, all these organizations, all these politicians, they are having new compromises. Europe had the embargo on Russian gas, and now, Russia is Azerbaijan is reselling Russian gas, and everyone are okay with that. And this is unacceptable. I think we should work together and to build some kind of new systems that will not fail us.
Arshak Makijan, we want to thank you for being with us. Exiled Russian Armenian anti-war human rights and climate activist. His Russian citizenship was revoked in 2023. He was denied a visa to Azerbaijan to attend the UN climate talks. He's now based in Berlin, Germany. Next up, President-elect Trump has nominated the Project 2025 architect, Russell Vogt, to lead the Office of Management and Budget again. We'll look at ProPublica's investigation into Vogt's plans to fire thousands of civil servants and his support for deploying the military domestically. That's here at home and more. Stay with us.
If this world were mine, I would place at your feet all that I own. You've been so good to me. If this world were mine, I'd give you the flowers, the birds and the bees, and this world were mine, I'd give you anything.
If this world were mine, I would make.
If this world were mine, performed by Cheryl Lynn and Luther Vandross. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. President-elect Donald Trump tried to distance himself during his campaign from Project 2025, the radical right-wing plan for a second term. But on Friday, he nominated a key architect of the plan, Russell Vogt, to lead the Office of Management and Budget once again. Vogt had led the office during Trump's first term for a time. The Trump loyalist wrote the chapter of Project 2025 that lays out how to redefine the executive branch by firing thousands of civil servants. He's also supported deploying the military here at home. In a minute, we'll be joined by the ProPublica reporter whose recent investigation of voters headline put them in trauma inside a key MAGA leader's plans for a new Trump agenda. It's based in part on videos ProPublica and documented obtained of private speeches Vogt gave at invitation-only annual gatherings at his pro-Trump think tank, the Center for Renewing America. This is a clip from a speech earlier this year when Vogt outlines the legal rationale for invoking the Insurrection Act, a law that empowers the president to use the military for domestic law enforcement.
We are trying to build at the Center for Renewing America almost a shadow office of management and budget. We're trying to build a shadow office of legal counsel so that when a future president says, what legal authorities do I need to shut down the riots? We want to be able to shut down the riots and not have the legal community or the defense community to come in and say that's an inappropriate use of what you're trying to do.
That's Russell Vogt, Trump's nominee to head the Office of Management and Budget, key Project 2025 architect. This is an excerpt of another video ProPublica and documented obtained. It's from a speech last year by Vogt delivered during a private gathering of the Center for Renewing America, that pro-Trump think tank. Here, Vogt describes his goal of defunding federal bureaucracies under a potential Trump second administration.
We want the bureaucrats to be traumatically affected. We want, when they wake up in the morning, we want them to not want to go to work because they are increasingly viewed as the villains. We want their funding to be shut down so that the EPA can't do all of the rules against our energy industry because they have no bandwidth financially to do so. We want to put them in trauma.
So that's Project 2025 architect Russell Vogt speaking in a video obtained by Molly Redden, reporter at ProPublica, who covers national politics and elections. Molly, welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't you lay out what you found, the most important takeaways from these videos that have that you've now gotten a hold of, who Vogt is?
Vogt was the director of the Office and Management of Management and Budget at the end of Trump's first term, and he's returning to that position. What that office does is it sets spending priorities for the entire federal government. So Congress writes the check, and then the OMB directs how that money is spent, either through regulations or just pipelining the money. And there's obviously a lot of power in that. And Vogt, you know, what he talked about in these videos and these sort of unguarded moments is a really expansive and aggressive vision of executive power to sort of take that money and spend it the way that Trump envisions it for, you know, a stronger executive branch, less environmental regulation, really according to sort of what they laid out in Project 2025. So really not letting Congress control the spending agenda anymore, but leaving it in the hands of a very small group of people to achieve, you know, exactly what Trump laid out on the campaign trail and what Vogt and others laid out in Project 2025. So he's in a really powerful position, and he has a really targeted and aggressive vision of how to, you know, execute what Trump has been talking about.
Now, explain what the OMB does, the Office of Management and Budget, why it's such a powerful position.
It's such a powerful position because, first of all, it oversees all of the regulations that the administration puts out. So, you know, Congress can write a check for, you heard him in those videos talk about defunding the EPA and making sure regulators don't have what they need. So even if Congress appropriates money for clean water regulation, you know, scrubbing pollution from the atmosphere, Vogt and his, you know, agency can oversee how rules get technically written so that that money can dry up. That's just one example. You know, they really get into the details of how you spend money, and that's just so incredibly powerful because that's really where the rubber meets the road for any policy in any administration.
And talk more about how he would, why being in that position would matter when it comes to his support for deploying the military at home on the streets of the United States?
That has a little bit more to do with the work that Vogt did between the two Trump administrations. So he founded a think tank called the Center for Renewing America. And what that think tank did is, in between the two administrations, sort of in that interim, it played host to a number of people who had been in high up positions of the Trump administration. And they, you know, incubated and drafted a lot of ideas for what a second Trump administration could do to execute its agenda more effectively. And I think we all remember from the first Trump administration, the president cycled through a lot of appointments who came from more traditional Republican institutional backgrounds. And a lot of them stood in the way, sort of acted as a bulwark against some of the more aggressive and, you know, history-defying things that Trump wanted to do, deploying the military against protesters during the summer of 2020. George Floyd protests is a really good example of this. And so, you know, that's over in the second Trump administration, right? You can see from his appointments whether they're, you know, people who have defended his agenda really aggressively on Fox News, or people like Russ Vogt who have been thinking for 4 years about how to build a legal framework and staff an administration that will do whatever Trump wants, that, you know, they are really focused on making sure that they have an administration that is loyal to Trump rather than, you know, focused on what existing law says you can do. So at the Center for Renewing America, one of the things that Vogt spoke about in those videos, they are preparing legal doctrines, basically, that will rationalize Trump's domestic deployment of the military. Another thing that Vogt has been a really big proponent of is, your viewers might be familiar with Schedule F, which is basically a way to reclassify government civil servants so that they're all political appointees and easier to fire if they don't comply with what the administration wants them to do.
Mm. Molly, I wanted to go back to August when we reported an undercover video that showed Russell Vogt bragging about his ties to Trump, even as Trump was trying to distance himself from Project 2025. It shows Vogt meeting in a 5-star Washington, D.C. hotel with two men who he thought were relatives of a wealthy conservative donor. He was actually talking to two undercover reporters with the Center for Climate Reporting, an independent British news outlet. They were secretly recording him. This is part of the video accompanying their investigation called Undercover in Project 2025, The Secret of Second Phase and the Radical Policies Set for Rollout on Day One.
We want to meet the man writing the game plan for Trump's second administration. Vogt believes that in his first term, Trump's agenda was frustrated by what he calls the deep state. So Vogt is planning a radical centralization of government power under the president, firing civil servants and ending the independence of agencies like the FBI and DOJ.
80% of my time is working on the plans of what's necessary to take control of these bureaucracies. And we are working doggedly on that, whether it's destroying their agency's notion of independence, they're independent from the president.
Vogt has also been preparing documents based on fringe legal theories, arguing the president has the power to use the military against protesters.
You know, George Floyd obviously was not about race. It was about destabilizing the Trump administration.
Right.
We put out, for instance, a 50-page paper designed for lawyers to know that the president has, you know, the ability both along the border and elsewhere to maintain law and order with the military, and that's something that you know, it's going to be important for him to remember and his lawyers to affirm. But we've given them the case for that.
With loyalists installed in key government agencies and armed with his playbook, Vogt believes a radical Christian nationalist agenda can be realized under a second Trump presidency. For example, on abortion.
So I think the president's actually come up with a strategy that works, so long as you are giving people like me in the government the ability to block funding for Planned Parenthood, block funding for fetal tissue research. But what I've told people is he had the most pro-life record ever. I've never seen him take it to stand in the way of a pro-life initiative that actually was real politically and with momentum.
So that was a report from a British climate justice group that went and spoke to him. He thought he was talking to, that's Russell Vogt, wealthy conservative donors. They videoed him as he spoke. But if you can comment from your research on the implications of what he said, right down to blocking the federal funding for Planned Parenthood, which runs hundreds of clinics all over the country for women's health care.
I think what you can see in that video and in some of our reporting is that a lot of what Trump said on the campaign trail to distance himself from things that were really unpopular, like Project 2025 and its vision for really concentrating an extremely aggressive amount of power in the executive branch, like new restrictions on abortion, on reproductive rights, on Planned Parenthood. I think what that shows is that a lot of that, those were political movements, those were political maneuvers meant to reassure voters who, really felt uneasy with voting for Trump, given that that's what his allies talked about his plans to do. And so I think, now that Trump has unified control of Congress and the Republicans and is feeling really good about, he's described himself as having a mandate, you're probably going to see a lot of what he denied he was going to do on the campaign trail. You're probably going to see that come to pass, at least some of it. I think Vogt's appointment is a really good piece of evidence for that. Vogt, as you described it, he was a key architect of Project 2025. A lot of the folks who worked at his think tank, the Center for Renewing America, were really instrumental in putting the plan together. He wrote a really key chapter about executive power and how to transform the presidency into the most powerful it's ever been. And so, I think Project 2025 is going to be right at home in the White House.
And where does the first act that President Trump is pushing as he becomes president again, and that is the mass deportation of immigrants and using the military to put them in camps and detention centers and then send them home, how does Vogt and what he's been describing facilitate that?
So what you heard him talk about was, again, helping come up with some of the legal rationalizations so that that can happen very quickly, so that they can try to do that very quickly and without a meaningful challenge. He talked about, in some of the videos we obtained, talked about trying to set the national conversation and make it a lot more extreme around migration. He and some other folks who worked for his think tank, people might remember Ken Cuccinelli, a top DHS executive or a top DHS official from the first Trump administration. They really kind of had like a private roadshow in 2022, trying to convince a lot of southern border governors to embrace this really, out there at the time, legal theory that migration at the southern border really constituted an invasion. So he really set the tone for that, too.
And Marjorie Taylor Greene is now going to head a subcommittee on government efficiency, and she says they will go after states and cities, cut off their funding if they make themselves sanctuary. Molly Redden, I want to thank you for being with us. ProPublica reporter will link to your investigation. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.